Ground Cover News is a nonprofit street paper that was founded in April 2010 as a means to empower low-income persons to make the transitions from homeless to housed and from jobless to employed. Vendors purchase each copy of the Ground Cover News regular edition at our office for 50 cents. This money goes towards production costs. Vendors work selling the paper on the street for $2, keeping all income and tips from each sale. This audio production was made possible by the Ann Arbor District Library, recorded at Fifth Avenue Studios. If you consistently enjoy Ground Cover Speaks, continuing to buy physical newspapers from Ground Cover vendors ensures that we can sustain production. The physical paper and in-person interaction is at the heart of our work. You can find the link to our next audio recording in the upcoming print issue of Ground Cover News. Thanks for listening.
Special thanks to our print advertisers, the People's Food Co-op, St. Francis of Assisi Parish, First Baptist Church, Bethlehem United Church of Christ, the Office of Community and Economic Development, Cineholic, Art on a Journey, Ann Arbor for Public Power, Four Directions, and the Ypsilanti Food Co-op.
Undercover Art Intel. Ann Arbor's art scene is wild. I took a small walk around downtown area and observed several events. The events truly show just how poppin' downtown is and why everyone needs to take advantage of what is left of summer. Walking past 10,000 Villages on Main Street, I saw a very large crowd of people gathering as if they were listening to slam poetry. The Art Expedition Being Black in Ann Arbor by the artist Asha Jordan was being featured at Culture Vista Gallery. I was drawn in by the amazing African dancer Imani at she flowed across the floor to the rhythm of the music. Her beaded skirt matched the movements of her hips and fast turns. The formerly imprisoned chairman of the Black Panthers, Baba Blair Anderson, exploded words of power and strength. I felt so honored to have heard raw truths cut like a knife through the soul. This made me feel that Ann Arbor is truly back from the grip of COVID-19 pandemic. I doubled back and heard party songs, saw more dancing in the wild. It was queer bingo time at the Avalon Bakery. I stood outside dancing to the club songs. This time the dancer wore a wild silver club dress and did high kicks and belly dance moves. When the music ended, I was invited inside to join in the fun. Bingo time. Believe it or not, I won a bag of Yum Yum cookies. Both events were about American culture and just how wonderfully inclusive we truly are. If you choose to live in separation, you become an 1800s horse with blinders on. We must take responsibility for how we act, no matter how we feel about the past. I choose to accept all people in a good way because that is who I am. Casca Dene, Wolf Clan warrior. In natural traditions, no one is left out, regardless of their choices. Peace must be honored. Join me for a wild time out in Ann Arbor. Jordan Black of Burlesque Drag Trope at Avalon Bakery, September 15th at 7 p.m.
Driver runs over homeless cyclist. Cops take no action. By Alexandra Granberg. Read by me, Simone Mossing. August 9th, at around 9 a.m., a car driver ran over and severely injured Gordy on the intersection of Michigan Avenue and South Grove Street in Ypsilanti. Gordy was on his bike, crossing Michigan Avenue on the sidewalk. The driver was turning out of South Grove onto Michigan Ave. Jill, Gordy's wife, who was right behind him, bent down under the car to find Gordy with one of the front tires pushed against his chest. She stood up and yelled at the driver to back up. The driver slowly backed away from Gordy and got out of the car to see the damage. Without asking if the man he had just run over was okay, the driver then called an ambulance. Gordy got up and started walking around in circles, delirious from the pain and breathing weirdly, according to Jill and Mikey, a friend and witness I spoke to for this article. Soon after, one of his lungs collapsed. Still, he was able to walk himself to the ambulance once it arrived. Police were the first to respond. They only took Gordy's first name, then spoke to Jill. When the cops asked Jill for an address, she told them they had none. She and Gordy are currently homeless and staying in a tent. Upon hearing this, the cops stopped taking notes. They handed Jill a business card and a case number without further questions for her or Gordy. Gordy does not know who the driver was, nor did he get the names of the cops. No pictures were taken at the scene. The ambulance driver told Jill she was not allowed to ride in the ambulance with her husband, according to protocol. Hit and walk? When he hit Gordy, the driver was past the stop sign and on his phone, according to Mikey. Both Gordy and Mikey say they saw the cops talking to the driver before letting him go without so much as a ticket. Before leaving the scene, the cops informed Gordy that he had been in the wrong for biking against traffic on the sidewalk and told him to get a lawyer. According to Michigan traffic law, cyclists can ride on sidewalks unless restricted by a local ordinance. And when using the sidewalk legally, a cyclist has all the same rights as a pedestrian. Under an applicable Ypsilanti ordinance, sidewalk cycling is allowed in all city parts except, quote, in any business district of the city, unquote. Which areas are included in the quote-unquote business district is not defined in the text, nor is it made clear after a surprising amount of research, including digging through city documents with the help of a former city planner. Steve Wilcoxon, mayor pro tem and council liaison to the Ypsilanti Non-Motorized Advisory Committee, seems just as confused by the wording. He tells me the term is not a zoning classification. However, the area which makes up quote-unquote the center of Ypsilanti ends a block before Grove Street on Michigan Avenue. Wilcoxon also said, quote, police officers are fairly ignorant about bicycle laws, unquote, and that, quote, many people ride on the sidewalk there, unquote. There is no bike lane on that stretch of Michigan Avenue. Broken breathing. Gordy walked away with a broken collarbone, a number of fractures on his ribs, and a punctured lung. He spent a week in the hospital. When I talked to him on the phone, he sounded tired, but under the circumstances, upbeat. Quote, I'm still breathing, unquote. It was the first time he told the story to anyone beside his peers. 2 weeks after the incident, no authority had yet contacted Gordy or Jill. No law enforcement representative has asked for Gordy's statement. Despite the physical and psychological trauma, the 43-year-old now has trouble sleeping and freezes at the sight of a car. Gordy said it could be worse. Quote, it could have been a kid biking down that road, unquote. Still, he said, quote, I feel this would be handled differently had it been someone of higher standing than myself, unquote. Ground Cover News will follow the development of this case.
Delanis is deteriorating. By DA Ground Cover contributor, read by LaShawn Courtright. I'm writing this article believing that we are more than what is becoming of human services organizations. The principles of a thriving, productive, transitional facility is to promote health, well-being, and tend to individual goals for clients whose only commonality is the lack of sustainable housing. Those are people who are at risk of harm, scrutiny, and dejection of the human spirit. I can believe that the clients may have similarities, yet bear varied needs. By grouping individuals as a whole, they are turning a blind eye to the fact that people may be beaten by self-harm, whether it is intentional or not. They should not need to continue to experience hopelessness at a homeless person's shelter. After not being able to utilize the services of a particular homeless person's shelter, I am untrusting about any shelter now. I have no trust in what the Robert J. Delano Center is now. I guess some call it a refuge. As a woman enduring a brain injury, I have been verbally assaulted by men on the premises of the shelter. As a result of speaking up about my rights being openly violated, staff have blocked access to their facilities and protection. They've witnessed me being physically assaulted in front of the shelter in the middle of the night. Four staff members came down to the entrance door to the shelter and instructed me to leave the property. Not one of them asked if I was all right. Once again, promoting safety was not their priority. The employees should always keep in mind their position as people who are employed as human services workers that have an ethic. They have an oath to uphold that they will promote safety, humanity, and fairness. Wherever they may be at the time of your encounter with them, all human beings on the property of the shelter. Until recently, I had never slept in front of the shelter or on the street. It is the most dangerous, vulnerable place for a person of any gender to sleep. A so-called female staff member made me sleep outside in March in freezing weather because I have a brain injury and use a walker. She wrongfully demanded that I leave the women's fourth floor at 7:30 a.m., whereas it is the rule and standard that everyone is expected to leave the fourth floor at 8 a.m. At 7:30 a.m., I gathered what I could, went to the first main floor to wash and dress. As I was washing myself, the male on duty, the first floor receptionist, kept busting in the bathroom without knocking or using any verbal alerts. As I stood half naked trying to take care of my hygiene, he demanded that I hurry up and get out. No one can wash themselves, fully dressed, and brush their teeth in 10 minutes, especially an individual who has a brain injury who requires an aid. I'm going to level down because there are genuine devoted staff members who exhibit a neutral character. Yet some will not speak up about the fraternizing that goes on between some of the staff and clients. There is no modesty in some of the apparel that most of the female staff comes to work dressed in. I would realize as a human services employee that wearing coochie cutter shorts to work is a distraction to some people and not professional attire. Whether it is male or female, I believe that it would come to mind that you are not at home. You are at the shelter to reveal available community resources, not your personal goods. People need enlightenment, hope, not another false roller coaster ride. When people know they have choices and the ability to overcome their issues, that is the most wonderful gift you can offer anyone. Landlords' unreasonable requirements are a way to reject people that are low income. It is ridiculous and reckless to only rent to individuals whose income is higher than $6,000 a month. It is a form of concealing that they are discriminating against you for being poor. It is a method of accelerating gentrification and prolonging time spent in shelters or on the street. Why not care for others with righteous works? As you are lifting one up, you may also be lifting yourself up. Let your work be a true reflection of what you are supposed to do. It takes all of us to make things go right. Offer people literacy programs, mental health services, job skills training, and show people how to effectively fill out a job application and learn creative resume writing skills. Make sure clients are being proactive in searching for housing prospects. When we ensure individual clients that they are empowered, and they can believe in themselves, this is a start to building community and independence.
The rent is too damn high. Statewide action demands lift of rent control ban in Michigan. This is an article by Ground Cover contributor Zachariah Farah, read by me, Ground Cover editor Cynthia Price. On September 5th, a crowd of several hundred renters from across the state of Michigan gathered on the steps of the Michigan State Capitol building in Lansing to make a simple proclamation: the rent is too damn high. The crowd, carrying flowing red banners, buzzed with excitement and energy. This was the first rally demanding better conditions for renters in many years at the Capitol, and there was a real sense that change could be won. The four demands presented by the aptly named Rent is Too Damn High Coalition are simple and cogent. 1. Repeal the statewide ban on rent control so cities can implement rent stabilization measures. 2. Pass a renter's bill of rights to greatly expand the legal protections shielding tenants from abusive landlords. 3. Invest $4 billion in social housing that is permanently affordable and publicly owned. 4. Allocate $1 billion to Housing First programs designed to provide housing to people experiencing homelessness. The event began with emotional speeches delivered by tenants who had been mistreated by their landlords, struggled to make rent, and faced evictions from their homes. Local renter and Huron Valley Democratic Socialists of America member Justin Yuan represented the McKinley Tenant Association, which has been working to improve conditions at McKinley Properties, one of the largest landlords in Washtenaw County. "Just as we fight the boss at work, we must fight the landlord at home," declared Yuan, whose comments were met with loud applause. Despite the intense 90-degree heat, the vibrance of the crowd continued throughout the speeches. After the tenant testimonials, we split into two groups, each directed towards a different chamber of the legislature, the House or the Senate. Both chambers are located in opposite wings of the Capitol. To our disappointment, the legislators had unexpectedly given themselves an extra day of vacation and weren't present on the chamber floors. We filed into the horseshoe-shaped galleries overlooking the debate floor and the many rows of empty legislators' desks. Call and response chants boomed throughout the hallways and rooms. "The roof, the roof, the roof is falling in. We're fighting for good housing, and you bet we're going to win." I was overwhelmed with the feeling that this previously silent room had been transformed into a living people's house. "We read our demands once again to our invisible legislators. It looks like our legislators are hiding," said one speaker in reference to the absence of the representatives. That wasn't true of all our legislators, however. Senator Kerry Reingans, Representative Emily Devendorf, Representative Jimmy Wilson Jr., and Representative Jason Morgan all attended the rally and demonstrated genuine support for our cause. Representative Morgan, who represents part of Ann Arbor, extended an invitation to the Ann Arbor area delegation to discuss our concerns and demands in his office. The meeting was a great success, and upon debriefing, our delegation agreed that it couldn't have gone any better. "At least we have a real ally in our own district," said one renter. After the exhausting day of demonstration, our delegation boarded our charter bus and we began the stretch back home to Ann Arbor. Reflecting on our rally, a wave of hope came over me. This is the beginning of a powerful tenant movement in our state, a movement that will win better rights and lower rents for tenants across Michigan. The Rent is Too Damn High Coalition will continue the fight in Lansing with our support, but it's up to us to get organized here in Ann Arbor. And the article is accompanied by two images. One is of a highly charged group of demonstrators chanting and airing their demands in the Senate chambers. And that photograph is by me, Cynthia Price. And the other is of Justin Yuan from Mechanic Tenants Association addressing the crowd. And that was courtesy of the Rent is Too Damn High Coalition.
GEO wins historic contract after five-month strike, by Joshua Lee. On August 25th, the University of Michigan and the Graduate Employees Organization reached a breakthrough agreement, ending a nearly five-month strike. This pivotal development won substantial pay raises for graduate student instructors and staff assistants, accompanied by a range of additional benefits. The labor strike, which began in late March, was a dispute that not only disrupted the U of M campus, but also led to legal proceedings. Few strikes ever go through the full range of procedures. Representing approximately 2,300 graduate student instructors and staff assistants across U of M's three campuses, GEO spearheaded this ongoing battle, championing improved compensation and benefits. Members of GEO deliberated during a mass meeting on August 21st and ultimately authorized their bargaining team to pursue a tentative agreement with the university. The union conducted a ratification vote on August 24th, which had a 97% approval. This accord spells the end of a highly charged strike, fostering a return to normalcy for both the U of M undergraduate community and the parties directly involved. The protracted strike led to a series of disruptions, including professors stepping in to undertake grading tasks typically handled by graduate students. Legally, the university sought a court order compelling striking workers back to their posts, a request that was ultimately denied. Union leaders voiced concerns about the university's handlings of student grades during the strike, prompting an inquiry from the accrediting body, the Higher Learning Commission. Despite these challenges, the union's persistence and the university's engagement in negotiations have paved the way for this historic agreement. The university's proposal, its last, best, and final offer, encompasses an 8% raise in the first year of the contract, complemented by successive 6% raises in the second and third years. Targeting graduate student instructors and staff assistants stationed at U of M's Ann Arbor campus, this proposition acknowledges the pivotal role these individuals play in the university's operations, ranging from grading assignments and exams to leading classes and contributing to diverse university initiatives. However, this journey through negotiations has not been without its challenges. GEO began its campaign with the fact that the skyrocketing inflation in the past years has put its members' salaries 60% below the estimated cost of living for Ann Arbor. This is why the union initially advocated for a substantial 60% raise in the first year of the three-year contract. While the agreement does not meet its demand fully, a de facto 60% raise will be realized for many graduate workers due to a separate graduate funding plan, aka Rackham Plan, pushed forward by U of M this spring as a union-breaking strategy. This plan, designed to ensure summer funding for PhD students, is set to remain intact. The strategic combination of these initiatives, according to GEO spokesperson and doctoral political science candidate Amir Fleischmann, yields a substantial raise for most PhD students in the contract's initial year. Fleischmann further suggests that incoming PhD students could experience a remarkable 80% raise by the conclusion of the contract, compared to their earnings in the previous contract cycle. Beyond the salary, this resolution introduces essential safeguards for graduate student instructors and staff assistants. For example, the settlement includes a transitional funding program aimed at shielding workers from harassment and potential threats. This three-year pilot initiative will provide funding for up to a semester, allowing students to transition out of situations involving abuse or discriminatory relationships with their supervisors or colleagues. Furthermore, enhancements in mental and physical therapy copays, in conjunction with the expansion of gender-affirming beliefs, underscore the university's commitment to fostering a supportive and inclusive environment for all stakeholders. In a statement, GEO-led negotiator Evelyn Smith highlighted the historic significance of the agreement, noting that the achievements attained were a result of collective determination rather than unilateral generosity. The union's long-haul strike was the driving force behind these successes. According to U of M spokesperson Rick Fitzgerald, the agreement holds significant implications. It provides the university with the assurance that the fall term will proceed without disruptions, reaffirming the institution's dedication to its core educational mission. It's worth noting that the deal offers more favorable terms to U of M graduate students in Ann Arbor compared to those in Dearborn and Flint, despite the union's consistent proposals for pay parity across campuses. While U of M Dearborn graduate student workers will receive annual raises of 3.5% through the contract's three-year term, efforts are underway to align the minimum stipend for the Flint campus along with the Dearborn standard. Additionally, graduate students across all three campuses are set to receive a $1,000 bonus. CEO Treasurer Prayag Chatta has started a solidarity fund to redistribute the bonus to members who lost their paycheck in April during the strike and to those who will not enjoy the full benefits of the new contract. Many members have pledged to donate their bonus. Anyone can make a contribution to givebutter.com/GEO strike fund. We fought tooth and nail over 10 months of bargaining and 5 months of strike action, forcing U of M to grant the largest salary increase in GEO history, the union wrote early Friday on X, the social media platform formerly known as Twitter. The University of Michigan and its graduate student workers have voted to restore equilibrium to their academic ecosystem. The impending resolution serves as a testament to the power of negotiations, advocacy, and collective action in driving transformative change. The settlement underscores the pivotal role that graduate students play in the functioning of higher education institutions. As the curtain falls on this chapter of the University of Michigan's history, the reverberations of these negotiations within the university community and the broader academic realm are inescapable. Lessons learned from this strike will undoubtedly shape the future dialogue surrounding equitable compensation, conducive working conditions, and a unifying spirit that propels progress towards shared goals.
Timeless Time by Ken Parks, ground cover vendor number 490. When I learn these two words, I begin to understand the seamless nature of past, present, and future. I learned that the first Karmapa, head of the Karmakagyu lineage, was called Dusum Kempa, translated as Knower of the Three Times, by virtue of his enlightenment experience in Timeless Time. This lineage is now headed by the 17th Karmapa. Obstacles arrive at every stage of the path in life, and it's good to work with whoever is available and helpful for your current situation. This may be a lifetime teacher or one of many. Your intention to realize the truth of reality is decisive, and cultivating that intention into experience and abilities is the goal. There is always work to be done. Our ancestors point the way, and all lineage holders carry that responsibility. Trungpa Rinpoche, who died in 2023, was an amazing teacher and writer. He was an important tutor to Ogun Trinley Dorji, who is a successor to the 16th Karmapa. Timeless Time brings the three times into a seamless whole. I've been accused of being stuck in the past and have been told to forget the past. My first response is detach from the past, honor and learn from the past. I do not know how much I am stuck in the past, but I certainly do not have a stable realization of timeless time that brings the seamless nature of the three times into clarity. Yet I dare to explore the truth as I understand it. I have mentioned awareness of the breath in many articles and still believe that one natural breath is more precious than all the words that could be written about awareness of this moment. Mindfulness can be a buzzword for compliance with social norms. Mindfulness and awareness have many levels. Gabor Mate has written The Myth of Normal to help us in our healing. Authenticity is precious and elusive because of habitual ego clinging. Most of us forget who we really are as we submit to survival demands and forget to thrive, that is, to live from the heart. We are surrounded by the bountiful fruit of the earth, yet often live with a scarcity mentality. Every indigenous heritage focuses on the sacred nature and generosity of the earth. Gratitude and contentment follow. It is a common practice in all communities with a heartfelt relationship to reality to call upon our ancestors to help live a balanced and engaged life. Cesar Chavez Presente was said three times in the many events that celebrated his contribution to our shared life. This exercise that some would say is akin to a seance put many of us in touch with the great commons, the all-good expanse of primordial purity. if you focus on the present as a measurement, you will only find nanomoments that disappear the present. Born from the past and immediately giving birth to the future, this moment is best experienced as the essence of the four times, past, present, future, and timeless time, which are seamless in the unity of stillness and motion. The unity of opposites is the key to experience the play of reality and enter the game of life with some confidence. If you are in Santa Clara, Cuba, visit the memorial to Che Guevara and get a taste of the four times. Remember Fidel's words that Che did not die because they meet in dreams and talk. The famous photo of Che by Korda is timeless. In my opinion, any experience is worthy as we learn more about who we are as individuals and as a people. I hope you meditated on the people are the power in the previous edition of Ground Cover. Any event is best understood with awareness of the four times. Take Labor Day as an example. We have yet to fully honor labor and get another chance as the number of strikes grows to a larger section of the working class. As a thought experiment, consider this year's Labor Day with timeless time in mind. Contrast the long history that goes back to May Day as International Workers' Day with the current focus on the Detroit Jazz Festival. Experience this historical moment deeply and tune in to the power of your labor and a fitting social connection to the emancipation of labor. May we become creatively productive and complete what needs to be done. The future begins now. The International Day of Peace is coming September 21st. Meet you on the Commons. Check out AnnArborCommunityCommons.org.
Title of the article is When Robert Frost Came to Michigan, A View of Power and Poetry in a Democracy. According to poets.org, Robert Frost's life can be summarized as follows. Frost was born on March 26, 1874, in San Francisco, where his father and mother had moved from Pennsylvania shortly after marrying. After the death of his father, when Frost was 11, he moved with his mother and sister to Lawrence, Massachusetts. He became interested in reading and writing poetry during his high school years in Lawrence. Enrolled at Dartmouth College in 1892, and later at Harvard University, though he never earned a formal degree. Frost drifted through a string of occupations after leaving school, working as a teacher, a cobbler, an editor of the Lawrence Sentinel. His first published poem, My Butterfly, appeared on November 8, 1894, in the New York newspaper called The Independent. Frost married his high school sweetheart, Eleanor Marion White, in 1895. It was said Eleanor, who died in 1938, was a major inspiration for his poetry. 4 years after her death, Frost proclaimed that he had a lover's quarrel with the world. Frost said he went to England to write a novel and perhaps dramatic plays. There he was influenced by renowned European poets such as Edward Thomas, Rupert Brooke, Robert Grace, John Keats, William Butler Yeats, and Thomas Hardy, and Georgian poets T.E. Homer and Lascelles Abercrombie. In 1917, Frost signed a 3-year teaching contract with Amherst College. He continued to be a prolific writer of poems. Many historians, including poets.org, noted that by 1920, Frost was the most celebrated poet in America. He got more famous with every new publications of his books. Frost won a total of 4 Pulitzer Prizes for poetry, the only poet to do so. He served as a consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress, 1957 to 1959. In 1960, Frost won the Congressional Gold Medal, signed by President Eisenhower and presented by John F. Kennedy in 1962. Frost read his poem, The Gift, outright at JFK's inaugural ceremony on January 20th, 1961. After receiving an honorary master's degree in arts and letters from the University of Michigan in 1921, Frost came back to receive an honorary doctorate in law from U of M in 1962. Although Frost got honorary degrees from Dartmouth, Harvard, and other prestigious schools, he told friends that he valued and cherished the honorary degrees from Michigan, the campus he loved very much. Frost died in Boston in January of 1963, a few months after his spring 1962 commencement speech and poetry reading to an overflowing, joyous crowd at the Michigan Football Stadium. Next, Frost gets a teaching fellowship at U of M. Robert Frost arrived at U of M in 1921, stayed until 1923, and then returned for a second fellowship in 1925 to 1926. He was invited by U of M's popular president, Reverend Dr. Marion Leroy Button. Frost and Button shared a vision about how poetry and the arts could transform the lives, thinking, and reflections of young people across the nation. President Button secured a $5,000 donation in 1921 to bring Frost to U of M. In his application for the grant, Button said, and I quote, "A real university should be a patron of arts, literature, and creativity. We ought to have on campus creative artists who are actually producing the results which influence the thoughts of a nation." The above quote by writer and scholar Paul Diamond was in the article titled "Frost and Button at Michigan, 1921 to 1926. Published by the Michigan Quarterly Review of July 14, 2023. In his acceptance letter, Frost thanked President Button for his vision of keeping the creative and the erudite together in education, where they belong, and where the creative can also make its demand on young students. Diamond noted that Frost made a big impact at Michigan, and in quote he said, "He had led the monthly meetings at Professor Cowden's home on Olivier Avenue for students writers of the literary magazine called Whimsies." Frost shared his poems, and the students shared theirs, and then Frost will encourage them to keep their poems around for a while and deepen it. There was no doubt that having America's most famous poet helping Michigan students to excel was very positive. But some professors in the English department displayed a hostile attitude towards Frost due to his lacking formal academic degrees. Some of them described Frost as a college dropout who made as much money as full professors. Sadly, the student writers who appreciated Frost knew about the envy and resentment. They devoted the last issue of their 1923 publication to Frost as a token of gratitude. President Burton also felt triumphant and grateful. He wanted to make Frost's residency permanent with $6,000 annually from the University of Michigan's fund. Frost agreed in principle, but then Burton died suddenly of a heart attack. After Frost gave an emotional eulogy for his number one advocate, Frost decided to do just a final residency from 1925 to 1926. He continued his impressive work with student writers who changed the magazine's name to Outlanders. He lived with his family in a house on Pontiac Trail. The house has since been moved by the Ford Museum to Greenfield Village. Frost wrote dozens of poems at Michigan. His residency produced some of the most memorable of his poems, cited by lay people and the powerful. They include Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening, Spring Pools, and Fire and Ice. His poetry collection, titled New Hampshire, was published in 1924. It was dedicated to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and it won the 1924 Pulitzer Prize for Excellence in Poetry. During one of his frequent dinners at President Burton's house, Burton claimed that Frost might even be more popular than the football coach Fielding Yost because of his civic engagement and national celebrity status. Frost's response, according to Diamond, was a humorous challenge, in quote. Let's put that to the test. Schedule a reading for me at the same time as a home football game. More than 30,000 will be cheering at the Perry Field. The Hill Auditorium will be empty, since even I will be at the game, in quotes. The intersection of power and poetry in a democracy. Robert Frost described himself as a humanist. Some critics called him a poet inspired by rural rusticity, landscape, forest, and pastoral disposition. He also wrote about the social and political challenge of his time, including wars, women's rights, and the crushing poverty of the Great Depression. Frost wanted his students and readers to do deep thinking. He was inclined to write parables. Many people in positions of power loved his poetry collections. President John F. Kennedy invited him to read his poem in January 1961 at the presidential inauguration. He recited the poem, The Gift Outright, very dear to folks from New England. After the poet passed away, Amherst College invited President Kennedy to give a speech at a ceremony to dedicate the Robert E. Frost Memorial Library. His speech was about the link between poetry and power. As quoted in HuffPost, Entertainment of July 14, 2023, Kennedy said, "When power leads man to arrogance, poetry reminds him of his limitations. When power narrows the areas of man's concern, poetry reminds him of the richness and diversity of this existence. When power corrupts, poetry cleanses. For art establishes the basic human truth, which must serve as the touchstone of our judgment." Talking specifically about Frost in his 1963 remarks at Amherst, President Kennedy said, "Our national strength matters, but the spirit which informs and controls our strength matters just as much." This was the special significance of Frost. He brought an unsparing instinct for reality to bear on the platitudes and pieties of society. His sense of the human's tragedy fortified him against self-deception and easy consolation. A quote by Frost, "I have been," he wrote, "one acquainted with the night, and because he knew the midnight as well as the high noons, because he understood the ordeal as well as the triumph of the human spirit, he gave his age strength with which to overcome despair. At the bottom, he held a deep faith in the spirit of man, and it's hardly an accident that Frost coupled poetry with power, for he saw poetry as the means of saving power from itself." We believe JFK is right in his assessment of Frost, an artist in general. After his assassination the next month, November 1963, JFK's personal secretary found in the Oval Office some books of poetry by Robert Frost, as well as Ulysses by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Both Ulysses and many of Frost's poems, but especially Spring Pools, written when he was at the U of M, are about the need for thoughtful and slow deliberation and not rushing into important decisions. It is safe to say that JFK learned from reading Frost and embraced these values. Extra, two poems written by Robert Frost when he was at the University of Michigan. The first one I'm going to read is Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening. The second one is Spring Pool. Let's read the first one. Stopping by the woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there's some mistake. The only other sound, the sweep of easy wind and dowry flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promised to keep and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. This is the poem, Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost. The next poem, which is very short, is Spring Pools by Robert Frost, written in Ann Arbor. These pools that dwell in forest still reflect the total sky almost without defect, and like the flowers beside them, chill and shiver. Will like the flowers beside them soon be gone, and yet not out by any brook or river, but up by roots to bring dark foliage on. The trees that have it in their pent-up boughs to darken nature and be the summer's woods. Let them think twice before they use their powers to blot out and drink up and sweep away these flowery waters and these watery flowers from snow that melted only yesterday.